Wisconsin's Educational Approval Board is a small agency that Governor Scott Walker says state government can do without. But Democratic lawmakers say it's more important now than ever. To tell us about the EAB, thanks to its executive secretary, David Dees, for joining us today. Mr. Dees, welcome to Wisconsin Eye.
Thank you very much.
Glad well, to be here. Is it fair to say most people don't know about the Educational Approval Board?
I think that is actually a fair characterization, and actually I think it's probably a good thing, because by design, the agency is really intended to prevent problems from happening in the first place. So if we're able to prevent them from happening, mm-hmm. and when they do arise, we're able to resolve them before somebody has a need to contact the media or contact their legislator, that's a good thing.
Well, give us a short version then of the mission of the EAB.
Yeah. We're a state regulatory agency that oversees post-secondary institutions that operate we call them schools, colleges, or universities, essentially. Anybody who's providing, post-secondary education and training to Wisconsin residents, for the most part, those institutions fall into either a private for-profit type of institution or an out-of-state nonprofit institution that comes into Wisconsin, either with campuses such as Upper Iowa University, mm-hmm. or they beam those programs in via distance learning in the state of Wisconsin.
Just to clarify, the EAB doesn't have any oversight over the 26 UW campuses.
That's correct.
The 16 technical colleges. The 23 members of the Association of Independent Colleges.
Correct. There are some specific. Yep. There are some specific exemptions in the current law for public institutions. So not only do we not oversee the University of Wisconsin system here in the state of Wisconsin or the technical college system, but we really exempt all public institutions, and that would also include out-of-state public institutions that might be doing some kind of distance learning activity here in the state of Wisconsin. So all public institutions, and then there's an exemption for in-state nonprofit institutions. So Edgewood College, located here in Madison, or others around the state like Beloit College or Ripon College, Marquette University, Lawrence, those members that you just kind of mentioned that fall into that organization under the Association of Independent Colleges.
How many colleges, schools, and universities do you have oversight over, sir?
Currently, we have 252 institutions that we have approved. Those institutions are serving somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 Wisconsin individuals in somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,200 different types of programs. There's about 428 unique programs across those 2,200 programs, but among the 252 institutions that we currently oversee, they're authorized to provide somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,200 different types of programs.
And the EAB, in one form or another, has been around since 1944 when it was created to be sure that America's veterans got
right.
a fair shake?
Following World War II, the influx of veterans and the creation of the GI Bill, that's really where the EAB has its genesis. The focus was, of course, on those veterans for a number of years, and then in the mid-50s, that focus shifted a little bit to look out for individuals of the state who may not have been veterans. And so that's when you saw not just Wisconsin, but a lot of states kind of shifting that focus away from just veterans and looking at their citizens more generally.
How many employees, and what's your budget?
Well, our current employee count is 6.5 full-time equivalents. Our budget for fiscal 15 is $606,500. We are a program revenue funded agency, so that money comes from the schools that we oversee. Essentially, there's a fee associated with the work that we do, various types, and so that money is what we use to sustain the operations of the agency. I should add that by law, we're required actually to assess the schools an additional 10% above and beyond what it costs to support the agency, and that money is sent over to the state's general fund as something called GPR earned. Mm-hmm. Last year in fiscal 14, it was around $82,000 based on current revenue numbers. For fiscal 15, we expect that number to be a little bit over $100,000. So if we eliminate the agency, it's a hole that will have to be filled by the legislature.
Well, you seem to be kind of a bargain. I mean, taxpayers don't pay for you. And you're able to send over the general fund $82,000. So what, have you been given a reason why the governor's budget would abolish the agency, sir?
We haven't, other than some of the information that was released when the governor introduced his budget, which basically identified a fiscal and regulatory burden. I'm guessing that the fiscal burden that he may have been talking about is tied to the burden on the institutions. I think we have prepared a number of different materials and have tried to address both of those issues, tried to educate legislators as to how we believe those are misconceptions, that there really is not a fiscal burden or a regulatory burden on these institutions. So when you look at the amount that we assess, that $600,000 to, and some change to support the agency, when you look at that in the context of the amount of revenue that the institutions are generating.
How much is it? How big of a business is for-profit
colleges? It's quite significant. In the last year for which we have numbers, which would have been essentially a kind of a fiscal 14 kind of a figure, we'll be starting to gather more information should the agency exist beginning
ongoing.
This summer.
Sure.
But they generated $351.6 million in tuition and fee revenue from Wisconsin.
I want to land on that number, just to be sure I understand it. So students of for-profit colleges, university, and schools paid $351.6 million.
Correct.
To attend these institutions which your agency oversees.
Correct. And for the, I guess, the cost of doing business for them essentially was the $606,500 to support the agency.
Okay.
So when you actually kind of break that down, it really equates to less than 0.2%. I sometimes you like to say it's about $1.70 per 1,000 of revenue that the institutions generate.
Now, the 351.6 is how's that varied in recent years? Is that higher or lower than, say,
it's been dropping. 2 years ago, back in fiscal 13, that number was as high as $437 million. I know we'll probably touch on some student outcomes in a little bit, but
yeah, let's do that.
Clearly, one of the things that we've seen is actually a declining number of students attending for-profit institutions. So the enrollment numbers are down significantly from where they were. We think they're were as high as 60,000 on an annual basis, and as we have kind of refined some of our data collection methods, we're actually able to sort of get better information, better data, and that number now looks like it's probably closer to 40,000 on an annual basis
so
that are being served by these 252 institutions.
Can I divide the 40,000 into 351.6 million to get average tuition?
Yes, you could.
I haven't done the math.
Yes, I think we have, but I can't tell you what the number is off the top of my head. But yes, we've kind of looked at that. That's one of the ways we actually do some validating of some of the numbers, so that when schools are reporting information to us, that's one of the calculations that some of our consultants are doing to say, do they sort of add up? You know, are these numbers making sense?
Okay. Well, thanks for providing us at Wisconsin I with some numbers. So let's look at the enrollment by cohort. First of all, can you define cohort for us?
Sure.
Because I can't.
it's real simply a 12-month group of students that start at an institution.
Okay, let's go down. So for the 2013 cohort, 21,210 students,
right.
But that's a drop of 17% in 1 year, sir?
Right. Yeah.
Why?
Well, I think there are probably a number of reasons for that. Clearly, some of the media attention, I think, at a national level is driving that number. I know as we kind of get in, you're going to actually see that the most significant part of that drop is with institutions that have an on-ground, a location here in the state of Wisconsin. So it seems like online is losing a little bit, but clearly not as significant as the on-ground. Some of that is due to the fact that there have been a number of institutions that have pulled out of the state of Wisconsin or have precipitously closed. So last August, Anthem College, which was located in Brookfield, closed its doors. We learned about the closure on a Tuesday afternoon around 5:15, and by Friday, the institution was essentially closed, had locked its doors, and was not going to be providing any further education.
Do they have to give you notice to the?
Well, yeah, it's great. We prefer more than 2.5 days. We do have a number of sort of planned orderly closures where institutions are taking a look at their numbers and saying, where is it profitable for us to be operating? Where is it not? And so we are currently, we were just notified about a week ago that DeVry University was going to close its physical campus
in the city
in the
of
Milwaukee area. Correct.
And I think that campus had been open since 1983.
Right. It's been around for quite some time. So part of the drop is that there are institutions that are just choosing to kind of leave the market here in Wisconsin in terms of, they're serving individuals. I think one of the things that they're looking at is, can they produce positive results
outcomes,
with
huh?
students, right? Can they can they produce positive outcomes? And it's not just the Educational Approval Board that's interested in some of that information, but they're also being looked at by their accreditor. They're being looked at by the U.S. Department of Education, and where they're not being successful, they're leaving the marketplace.
Are there tougher getting ready for the show? I found some reference to tougher federal standards. Are there tougher standards in place?
Absolutely. Yeah, there are a number of things that are kind of either in the works or that are being implemented as we speak. Probably the most well known are the gainful employment rules, which are going to really take a look at what type of return on investment are students getting for the type of training that they're receiving. And so they're going to be, I think, looking at some of that information. So, yeah, definitely. A few years ago, they switched from a 2-year cohort default rate to a 3-year cohort default rate. So there are a whole series. I think there's probably more that are out there that are likely to be coming. There's a lot of discussion around things like kind of the 90-10 rule, which basically require institutions to get 10% of their revenue from some other source than federal financial aid dollars.
I see.
And so there are a number of tightening provisions, I think, at the federal level that are certainly having a play in what we're seeing with these numbers.
Okay, let's go back to this chart, because you just mentioned it. In 2013, equally divided between online and on-ground, however, as you say, the biggest drop in the chart, which was provided by you and your agency, 23% drop-off in on-ground. On-ground means someone is physically attending a classroom?
Well, correct. It means that the institution is here in a physical way where they have classrooms and there's face-to-face instruction occurring.
Okay. When we look at the for-profit, non-profit, I was struck. 90% of our Wisconsin students are attending for-profit, but this is also a drop of 18%.
Correct.
Any thoughts on that, sir? Analysis, context?
Well, I mean, historically, we've overseen more for-profit institutions. We have been approving in the last 2 years a significant number of nonprofit institutions that are wanting to get into the distance learning kind of environment. So, what we're seeing is really, I think, a reflection of the fact that from a historical standpoint, the only really way for numbers to move with the for-profits was probably down to some extent because, it reached saturation, and I think what we're seeing is a correction. Steve, the other thing that I think people, sometimes, people who work within higher education understand this, but post-secondary ed higher education is somewhat counter-cyclical. So that as the economy improves, what you find are places for these individuals to obtain employment, and they don't feel that they need to perhaps attain as much education or training. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure that that's also one of the things that's perhaps responsible for a drop in the numbers of students, is that you're not seeing as many students looking for that education or training opportunity because they're finding employment instead. And so, like I say, it's kind of a combination of some things. But I think the only way, that it could probably have gone for the for-profits was probably down.
Well, the final category on this first chart, sir, degree
versus non-degree.
Degree versus non-degree. This is a 2-to-1 ratio. It's students chasing a degree, but it's also 20% drop-off.
Right.
What does non-degree mean? What type of classes would someone be taking for non-degree?
Well, so in addition to some of the larger institutions that we've been talking about that offer an associate degree or a bachelor's degree or higher, we also approve about 110 institutions that we sort of put into a category of non-degree granting institution. And those would be, here in the state of Wisconsin, we have truck driving institutions, taxidermy, welding, pet grooming, massage therapy. There are a whole plethora of institutions where an individual will earn a certificate or a diploma. It's not an associate degree or bachelor's degree like you might otherwise receive if you were attending Globe University of the University of Phoenix or ITT Technical Institute. So we have a large number of institutions that operate really almost in a little bit different space within that continuum of post-secondary education.
Let's talk about the average student. Mm-hmm. Is it a he or a she? Who is most likely? Do you have a demographic profile?
We do. Now, if you were to talk about truck driving institutions, you're going to find mainly males that are going to be attending that kind of an institution. If you're looking
There's
at dental assisting.
There's a lot of jobs out there now and in the future for truck drivers.
Right.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're looking at a dental assisting school, though, let's say, you're probably going to be looking at primarily women that are attending that type of an institution. I think if you aggregate some of the data, what you're going to find is that there's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 65% female,
really?
The remaining being male.
Are they older than the traditional
Absolutely.
Student?
Absolutely. Yeah, 75 to 78% of the students that are attending institutions that the agency oversees are non-traditional students, meaning they're 25 years of age or older. Most of them are going to be in their 30s and 40s. So these are individuals who are looking for a way to change perhaps the current career path that they're on. They're looking to maybe change careers altogether. They're looking to fulfill some type of a dream that they have, and they're looking at these institutions
How
as place of opportunity.
How many classes or credits do they take in any one time, semester or quarter?
Well, it's, I think, really all over the board. One of the reasons why for-profit institutions in particular are attractive to these individuals is because they offer flexible scheduling. They offer quicker starts. So if you wanted to sign up today at a traditional institution, whether it be a public or a nonprofit institution, you wouldn't be able to start until September. If you want to enroll at Madison or at Edgewood, you're going to, well, maybe you can get in the summer, but typically you're going to wait till probably fall in order to start your educational pursuits.
Yeah.
With many of the for-profit, they operate year-round. They may have a start within a week or two of when you reach out to them. So that's one of the reasons why I think students perhaps sometimes, particularly non-traditional students, will gravitate towards these non-traditional institutions.
Are they paying cheaper tuition than those at the UW system campuses, the tech colleges? Or?
Well, they're going to be paying more tuition than you would higher tuition than you would at a public institution, in part because public institutions have that tuition subsidized. They're going to probably pay a little bit less, though, than you would pay at a nonprofit institution. So if you go look at the sticker price of Edgewood or Marquette, it's going to be a little bit higher. So if you take a look at some of the federal data in terms of where the institutions rank, you will find that private for-profit institutions sort of fall between public and nonprofit. They're in the middle between those two. The one thing that I try to let people know when they ask and when they're interested in learning about this is that really the cost of education is pretty much the same across all the sectors. So if you took a bachelor's program, whatever it might happen to be, it really costs about the same to deliver that education. It's really what differs is how does the student pay for that? And there's a very strong partnership with the state and the student at a public institution.
Yes.
There's a lot of sort of what we would call institutional reallocation of dollars within the nonprofit, so that if you come to the institution, you have an ability to pay the sticker price, the tuition and fees that are stated, you will do that. But if you can't, they'll find some ways in which they can reallocate some dollars and to try to bring, you know, the cost of that student's attendance down.
Does your agency have any oversight over, number one, the tuition charged by these for-profits, and number two, who the instructors are or who the professors are?
We don't, in response to your first question, we don't have any controls over what the institutions are charging. You know, we certainly, in the approval process, you know, review that information. We'll certainly ask some questions. We feel that it's kind of an outlier when you look at other institutions offering a similar type of a program. In terms of the instructors, we do review background of instructor information, particularly for some of the non-degree institutions that I talked about earlier, because there is no accrediting agency that's involved. If an institution is accredited, we know that instructors have also been evaluated by the accreditor, and so our review isn't quite as deep. And a lot of what we do, whether it's with instructors or a lot of the other standards that we require schools to provide information to us about, is that we really don't necessarily prescribe them. We require the institution to have certain policies and procedures, and then we hold the schools accountable to their own standards. And so when we do get a complaint, we're oftentimes verifying whether or not the school violated its own policies and procedures. We haven't prescribed those. Now, there are some areas where we prescribe them. For instance, refunds. One of the things that we've learned over these five, six generations or whatever, it's been, or decades, I should say, when you take a look at the nature of the complaints, you know, clearly in that process, we saw that there was a lot of sort of concern, a lot of complaints all centered around refunds. So when a student leaves an institution for whatever reason, and there is some amount of money, you know, due back to the student, there were a lot of complaints. And
how many complaints does your agency get in a year?
Yeah, I'll get to that in just a quick second.
Go ahead.
So let me just kind of saw off that other piece. And so one of the things that we saw is that there needed to be some tightening. We need to be more prescriptive nature in terms of how the refund is calculated. So the state actually does, in that instance, prescribe a very structured process for how the refund is calculated. Yeah. We do the same thing in advertising and promotional materials. You know, there's just a lot of room for abuse in those areas, and so they're a little bit tighter than it would be for, let's say, do we require the school to have attendance? No. But if it does, it needs to follow their own policies and procedures, and then it is something that we can review if we get a complaint about, you know, the student's attendance, how it might have affected a grade, or if they got kicked out of the program, things like that. So your question in terms of complaints.
Yeah, number of complaints.
Right. At the onset, of course, I mentioned that one of the things that we try to do is prevent complaints from happening. But we, on an annual basis, get somewhere in the neighborhood of about 50 complaint inquiries. About half that number actually result in a formal investigation, where our staff are doing investigations. We're currently conducting a number of those as we speak, where we're gathering information and trying to figure out exactly what went wrong and how to best solve that, you know, student's problem.
Well, in its testimony, there was a public hearing on a bill that would formally abolish it.
Correct.
And one Wisconsin Now, let me find their quote. The industry targets veterans, minorities, and low-income students, encourages them to take on large student debts, and oftentimes leaves graduates with essentially worthless degrees. Now, I want to make clear, that's not your agency saying that.
Correct.
This is one Wisconsin Now, but is that generally accurate, or does it overstate it?
Well, I think it may overstate it a little bit. I think it needs to be put in some context. We talked about a little bit earlier the types of students that attend these institutions. Mm-hmm. You know, many of these individuals really don't have access to the traditional institutions. So based on kind of where they are in life, perhaps some of their prior education, which may now be a decade old or more since they may have attended, let's say, high school, trying to then get admitted to a four-year institution in the state, a more traditional institution, they may not be able to gain that access.
Okay.
And so they're looking for alternatives, and these clearly are alternatives. for these individuals.
Well, the other, it's time to look at the second chart here, sir, that I'm grateful for your agency to providing, because this is student outcomes 2012-2013 cohorts.
Right.
And what intrigues me is, now, are we measuring here 2 years, 2012 and 2013?
Well, we actually, we do have 2 years on the chart, but you can break it down by individual year, and that's kind of the change in terms of the, you know, the color of the graphs. That green bar kind of up on top represents the first year only of individuals that were from the 2013 cohort, and the other bar represents students who actually we've been tracking now that cohort for 2 years.
I want to do, I want to focus on the totals column, the 46,634.
Right.
Because of that, 16,802 dropped out, a dropout rate of 36%.
Correct.
Has that dropout rate changed much in the last few years? And are is that a troubling number, that one out of three drop out?
Yeah. Well, one, it's clearly something that we're looking at. You know, we clearly get concerned when we see somewhere in the neighborhood of 40% of students are dropping out, because we know that they've probably incurred some debt along the way.
Yes.
And so now these individuals have dropped out, don't have a credential in which to get a better paying job, to be able to pay off the debt that they've incurred.
Can I stop you on the debt issue?
Yep.
Are the students largely attending these for-profit colleges, are they generally more in debt than the class of 2015 at the UW-Madison, Oshkosh, or River Falls?
Yes, they are. We don't collect debt information, just because we don't track individual student information. Those who do, and most of it is really information that's based on individuals who've completed their education and training. So you do miss a big segment of those who don't complete their education. Presumably their debt would be a little bit lower. But of those who complete, we're seeing, I believe the U.S. Department of Education has a figure of close to $40,000 is the amount of debt on average that a student attending a for-profit college or university has accrued during their time of seeking that credential.
And that's significantly higher than if you graduate from a public
university. Right now, I believe the sort of, if you throw public institutions, private institutions, nonprofit institutions, sort of all into the same pot, that number is about 29,800 or something
That's
like that. So it's close to 30. So it's, 25% more than a for-profit institution student is going to have about 25% more than a nonprofit.
Let's finish talking about the second chart here. So 36% dropped out, 2% transferred, 35% continued, and 26% completed the program, getting a certificate or getting a degree.
Right.
Okay. And so this constitutes a makeup of the 46,634.
Right.
Another thing, getting ready for the show, I think it was also in the One Wisconsin Now testimony, they said the governor's bill would abolish the Student Protection Fund. Explain that to me. How much is in it, and who does it help, and why is it accumulating?
Yep. One of the things that we have available to us to address catastrophic school closures is a student protection fund. So that in the case of Anthem College that closed last August, we were able to use dollars that were in that fund to arrange for students to be taught out by another institution. So we basically were able to pick up the program and take it to another institution. There were a lot of pieces to that puzzle. We needed to get a lot of things in place.
So you were paying refunds to students from that?
Well, in some instances we paid refunds. So one was the teach out. So we allowed those individuals, where it made sense for them to be able to complete their education and training, given where they were within a program. Some students were weeks away from completing. Wouldn't make a lot of sense for them to sort of get a refund and then have to start all over.
Right.
So we found partner institutions where we were able to allow a certain number of students to finish their education. There were others where they were essentially given refunds or partial refunds.
Who builds up the fund?
Well, it was actually something that the schools over time had contributed to.
So they pay for your agency, they pay into the fund.
That's correct.
And then $82,000 is returned to the general fund.
There's a sort of a limit in terms of when the institutions have to pay into the fund. So anytime the balance of the fund drops below $1 million is when we can assess an additional fee to build the fund, you know, the fund back up.
Okay.
There had been about $1.7 million in that fund at the beginning of the current fiscal year. In July of 2014, we had about $1.7 million. Because of that Anthem closure, we're down a little bit under $1.4 million. So we're actually somewhere in the neighborhood of about $400,000 that we have used to really try to hold students harmless, either by facilitating a teach out. One of the things that we did is we negotiated with one of the private lenders that held debt obligations for these students. They'd taken out loans.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to be able to get their federal loans discharged, but no one was going to help them with the private student loan debt that they had also accumulated. And so what we did is worked out an arrangement where essentially the private lender wrote off about half of the collective debt, and we covered the other half of that debt, which is about $170,000 alone.
Okay, we're running short on time, mm-hmm. so just a couple more questions. If EAB is abolished, would there be anybody performing the functions that your agency now does, Mr. D?
Yeah, not really. If you take a look at the language that's contained both in the budget as well as the separate legislation that's been proposed, about 90% of our oversight responsibilities are simply repealed. There would be an authorization component that would be retained and performed by the new Department of Financial Institutions and Professional Standards,
mm-hmm.
But it's really more of a perfunctory authorization so that those institutions wouldn't lose access to federal financial aid. It would require them to look to see, do they have accreditation?
Kay.
If they have accreditation, they're authorized.
Okay.
Some of the complaint resolution functions would go over to the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection.
So you have a bifurcated process?
So there'd be a bifurcated process,
the
right?
The approval rests with the new Department of Financial Institutions?
Correct.
But if you have a complaint, it would go to DADCAP?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I think it's worth noting that the current sort of authorization as it relates to investigating complaints would not change for DADCAP. They'd really be restricted to looking at complaints that involve some kind of unfair trade marketing.
Oh.
So most of the kinds of complaints that we get don't involve that level of complaint. It's usually about the treatment of the student, the processing of a refund, admission into the program, or things along these lines, which are much different than I was lied to, misled when I signed up for the program. We do get a few of those, but they're typically not what we see on a regular basis. And given that they wouldn't have authority to deal with processing of refunds, you know, the treatment of a student, the quality of the program. You know, no one really, Wisconsin would really be the only state in the nation. That wouldn't have some evaluative process for these institutions.
Okay, well, maybe a final question is this. If you were testifying before the Joint Finance Committee and asked why your agency should remain part of state government, what's your short answer?
Well, we have, in fact, testified. You know, one of the things that we haven't quite touched on is the fact that while the agency exists, it's actually comprised of members of a board.
Yes.
Who are
seven member board?
Well, it's not more than seven.
Okay.
Currently, there are only five members who've been appointed to the board. They are appointed by the governor. They've come out in opposition to it. You need to understand that they're subject matter experts. Not only is the staff expert in terms of the work that we do, but the board members actually have a lot of experience working with either for-profit or within higher education in general. So they bring that knowledge, to the table to hopefully establish good policy. Clearly, we've been trying to educate members of the Joint Finance Committee, members of the respective standing committees about really what Wisconsin loses if one were the only state in the nation without some kind of a formal evaluative process. Frankly, as the board chair likes to say, it will be like Star Wars and the shield is down. We clearly open ourselves up to dubious kinds of folks just looking for a way to sort of have some legitimacy. I think it's one of the reasons why there are many institutions that are perplexed about the proposal that actually showed up and testified during the public hearings on the separate legislation to say this doesn't make any sense, because one of the things that the agency does is we provide a level playing field. There's a set of rules that everybody knows what they are, and without those rules, it becomes somewhat of a race to the bottom.
So EAB right now, just to summarize, oversees 40,000 students who last year paid $351 million in tuition.
Correct.
So that's a pretty important function that would seriously be cut back under the governor's budget.
We certainly think so.
David Dees, Executive Secretary of the Educational Approval Board, thanks for talking to Wisconsin Eye.
Appreciate you inviting me.
Thank you. Good.